I really appreciate you coming out. Yeah, so Shelby and Karin said, talk about torture, war crimes, and indigenous perspective on U.S. history. And I think that's exactly what I'm obsessed with. So that's what I will talk about. And I want to thank, I really want to thank Shelby and all the organizers and sponsors of this whole week and for doing this, and Code Pink and Veterans for Peace and everyone who's going to be a part of it. And I'm really honored to be a part of it. A Chickasaw scholar from Oklahoma, Jody Bird, wrote in her book, which I highly recommend, called Transit of Empire, quoting Jody Bird, that the continued colonization of American Indian nations, peoples, and lands provided the United States the economic and material resources needed to cast its imperialist gaze globally is a fact that is simultaneously obvious within and yet continually obscured by what is essentially an ever more perfect multicultural, multiracial democracy. The status of American Indians as sovereign nations colonized by the United States continues to haunt and inflect its stability and identity. So the conventional narrative of U.S. history segregates the Indian Wars as a subspecialization within the dubious category of the West. That's only a legitimate category if you start at New Jersey or New York or Virginia, not the Mississippi River or the Mountain West. Then there are the Westerns, those cheap novels, movies, and television shows that nearly every U.S. American absorbed with mother's milk, and that by the mid-20s, 20th century, were popular in every corner of the world, and how the world defined Native Americans and the United States itself. The Wild West. The architecture of U.S. world domination was designed and tested by the period of continental U.S. militarism, which built on the previous almost two centuries of British colonialism, and generated its own innovations in total war after independence. The opening of the 21st century saw a new, even more brazen form of U.S. militarism and imperialism explode on the world scene. For some of us who've been trying to characterize and make it clear that the United States is a colonial imperialist state from its founding, we welcome these, finally, people, you know, talking about the U.S. as imperialist power. But they still were not connecting it with the taking of the continent, at least not on the left. You'll find out they are talking about it in among others, military planners. The War on Terror included two major military invasions and hundreds of small wars employing U.S. special forces around the globe. One highly regarded military analysts stepped forward to make the connections between the Indian Wars and what he considered to be the country's bright imperialist past and future. Robert D. Kaplan, in his 2005 book, Imperial Grunts, presented several case studies that he considered highly successful operations. You may laugh at this first one, Yemen, Colombia, Mongolia, and the Philippines, in addition to ongoing complex projects in the Horn of Africa, Afghanistan, and Iraq. So while U.S. citizens and many of their elected representatives call for the end of U.S. military interventions they knew about, including Iraq and Afghanistan, Kaplan hailed protracted contemporary counterinsurgencies in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, Latin America, and the Pacific. In this book, Imperial Grunts, he presents a guide for the U.S. controlling those areas of the world based on its having achieved continental dominance in North America by means of counterinsurgency and employing total and unlimited war. Kaplan is the author of numerous best-selling books, including Balkan Ghosts and Surrender or Starve. That's a title that's very significant because that's how counterinsurgency works. Kaplan became one of the principal intellectual boosters for U.S. power in the world through the tried and true first way of war. This is the way of war dating back to the British colonial period that military historian John Grenier called a combination of unlimited war and irregular war, a military tradition that accepted, legitimized, and encouraged attacks upon and destruction of non-combatants, villages, and agricultural resources in shockingly violent campaigns to achieve their goals of conquest. Kaplan sums up his thesis in the prologue to Imperial Grunts, which he subtitles Engine Country. You probably know that the official term of the U.S. military for enemy territory is still Indian Country, often shortened to Engine Country or In Country. So quoting Kaplan, by the turn of the 21st century, the United States military had already appropriated the entire earth and was ready to flood the most obscure areas of it with troops at a moment's notice. The Pentagon divided the planet into five area commands, similar, and this is Kaplan, similar to the way that the Indian Country of the American West had been divided in the mid-19th century by the U.S. Army. According to the soldiers and Marines I met on the ground, Kaplan met on the ground, in far-flung corners of the earth, the comparison with the 19th century was apt. Welcome to Engine Country was the refrain I heard from troops from Colombia to the Philippines, including Afghanistan and Iraq. Kaplan challenges the concept of manifest destiny, that it was just, you know, just happened kind of automatically, that God was on the U.S. side, that it was just inevitable, arguing that it was never inevitable that the United States should have an empire in the western part of the North American continent. Rather, he argues, Western empire was brought about by small groups of frontiersmen separated from each other by great distances. Here Kaplan refers to what Grenier calls settler rangers, destroying indigenous towns and fields and food supplies. Although Kaplan downplays the role of the U.S. Army compared to the settler vigilantes, which he equates to modern special forces, he acknowledges that the regular army in the 19th century provided lethal backup for settler counterinsurgency, in slaughtering the buffalo, the food supply of the plains people, as well as making continuous raids on villages to kill or confine the families of the indigenous fighters, hold them hostage until the fighters, the resistors, turn themselves in. And Kaplan summarizes the genealogy of U.S. militarism today by writing, whereas the average American at the dawn of the new millennium found patriotic inspiration in the legacies of the Civil War and World War II, when the evils of slavery and fascism were confronted and vanquished, for commissioned and non-commissioned officers of the U.S. Army, the U.S. Army's defining moment was fighting the Indians. The legacy of the Indian Wars was palpable in the numerous military bases spread across the South and the Middle West, and particularly the Great Plains, the vast desert and steppe comprising the Army's historical heartland, punctuated by such storied outposts as Fort Hays, Fort Kearney, Fort Leavenworth, Fort Riley, and Fort Sill, Leavenworth, where the Oregon and Santa Fe trails separated, was now the home of the Army's command and general staff colleges. Fort Riley, the base of General Armstrong Custer's 7th Cavalry, now that of the 1st Infantry Division. And Fort Sill, where Geronimo and the other Apache resistors lived out their last years of their lives, the headquarters today of the U.S. Artillery. I grew up about 30 miles from there. While microscopic in size, it was a fast and irregular military actions against the Indians, memorialized in bronze and oil by Remington, that shaped the nature of American nationalism. That's still quote Kaplan. Although Kaplan relies principally on the late 19th century source of U.S. counterinsurgency, in a footnote, he reports what he learned at the Airborne Special Operations Museum in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Quote, "It is a small but interesting fact that members of the 101st Airborne Division, in preparation for their parachute drop on D-Day, shaved themselves in Mohawk style and applied war paint on their faces." Oh, sorry. I will try harder. This takes us back to the pre-independence colonial wars, and then through U.S. independence and the myth popularized by the Last of the Mohicans. Kaplan debunks the argument that the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11, 2001 brought the United States into a new era of warfare and prompted it to establish military bases around the world. Because prior to 2001, he rightly observes, the U.S. Army Special Operations Command had been carrying out maneuvers since the 1980s in 170 countries per year, with an average of 9 quiet professionals on each mission, that is, special forces. America's reach was long, its involvement in the obscurus states protean. Rather than the conscript army of citizen soldiers that fought World War II, there was now a professional military that, true to other imperial forces throughout history, enjoyed the soldiering life for its own sake. They worked ever since conscription ended in 1972 and was replaced by the... Oh, you want to switch it? Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Is it cutting out or something?
Yeah. We're just going to switch it and make sure you have a better mic. I'll
try that. Is that better? It's not on.
Hello?
Oh, okay. So they switched to, finally hit upon these small units that they put together all through training, and these are all the different armed forces. If they're directed toward combat, they stay together throughout their time in the military, and many of them becomes their family. Many of the young kids that sign up there come from dysfunctional families. It becomes really their family, and their best friends, and the commander kind of their father figure. And they re-enlist. They stay. Many of them stay in. So this is then whatever they're fighting, whoever the enemy is. The point is to save their brother or sister. I guess women are in combat now too. It doesn't matter what it's about. It's just a thing in itself. So that's pretty much how it's going back to the beginning, how the colonial militias worked. You can take Andrew Jackson as a kind of template of that, who, you know, became president then, but, you know, following through his career as a Tennessee militia founder. So what we have now also has already always existed. The shock of many people to learn about the tortured bodies, sexually violated bodies, imprisoned bodies, and dead bodies that had been tortured. And this arose as a primary topic in the first years of the George W. Bush administration following the September 2011 attacks, with a war of revenge against Afghanistan and the overthrow of the government of Iraq. Afghans resisting U.S. forces and others who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time were taken into custody, and most of them were sent to hastily constructed prison facilities on the U.S. military base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, on land the United States appropriated in its 1898 occupation of Cuba. Rather than bestowing the status of prisoner of war on the detainees, which would have given them certain rights under the Geneva Conventions, they were designated as, quote, unlawful combatants, a status previously unknown in the annals of even Western warfare. As such, or we thought so, as such, the detainees were subjected to torture by U.S. interrogators and shamelessly monitored by civilian psychologists and medical personnel. In response to questions and condemnations from around the globe, a University of California international law professor, John C. Yu, on leave to serve as Assistant U.S. Attorney General in the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel, penned on March 2003 what became the infamous torture memos. Not much was made at the time of one of the precedents, one of the main precedents that you employed to defend the designation unlawful combatant. This was the U.S. Supreme Court's 1873 opinion in Modoc Indian Prisoners. In 1872, a group of Modoc men, and the Modocs are no longer call themselves Modocs, if they ever did, that's the Pitt River Nation in Northern California. They were led by Ken Puash, also known as Captain Jack. They attempted to return to their own country in Northern California after the U.S. Army had rounded them up and forced them to share a reservation with unrelated people in Oregon. The insurgent group was 53 men, and they returned to their homeland and were subsequently surrounded by U.S. troops and Oregon militiamen. And they took refuge in the barren and rugged lava beds around Lassen Park. That's a part of their ancestral homeland that they knew every inch of. It's also sacred territory for them. More than 1,000 troops commanded by General Edward R.S. Canby, a former Civil War general, attempted to capture the resistors, but had no success as the Modocs engaged in effective guerrilla warfare. Before the Civil War, Canby had built his military career fighting in the 1821 Second Seminole War in Florida, and later in the 1848-46 invasion of Mexico. Posted to Utah on the eve of the Civil War, he had led attacks against the Navajos, and then he began his Civil War service based in New Mexico, rounding up and deporting Navajos and Apaches. Therefore, Canby was a seasoned Indian killer. In a negotiating meeting between the general and Kent Puash, the Modoc leader killed the general and the peace commissioners when they would allow no other resolution than surrender. In response, the United States sent another former Civil War general in with more than 1,000 additional soldiers as reinforcements, and in April 1873, these troops attacked the Modocs in the lava beds, this time forcing the fighters to scatter. After 4 months of hit-and-run fighting that cost the United States nearly $10 million and the lives of more than 400 of its soldiers and a general, the nationwide backlash against the MODOKs was vengeful. Kent Puash and several other captured MODOKs were given no trial. They were imprisoned and then hanged at Alcatraz, and the MODOK families were scattered and incarcerated on reservations, some as far away as in Oklahoma Indian Territory. Kent Puash's corpse was embalmed and exhibited at circuses around the country. I knew this is the case that you was relying upon. So he drew the legal analogy between the MODOK prisoners and the Guantanamo detainees. He employed the legal category of homo sacer in describing what unlawful combatant is. Homo sacer in Roman law is a person banned from society, excluded from its legal protections, but still subject to the sovereign power. Anyone may kill a homo sacer without it being considered murder. So as Jody Bird notes, one begins to understand why John C. Yoo's famous March 14, 2003 torture memos cited the 1873 MODOK Indian prisoners case. The legal opinion was used in order to articulate executive power in declaring the state of exception, particularly when the MODOK Indian prisoner's opinion explicitly marks the Indian combatant as homo sacer to the United States. To buttress his claim, Yoo quoted from the 1873 MODOK Indian prisoner's opinion, in which the Supreme Court actually described the reason for it. And this opinion, because it's never been challenged, it's still a standing opinion, law of the land, a part of the Constitution that we live with today. And he made a good case for this precedent. People kind of laughed at it and they didn't really talk about this part of it. So this is from the case itself, from the Supreme Court decision. It cannot be pretended that a United States soldier is guilty of murder if he kills a public enemy in battle, which would be the case if the municipal law were in force and applicable to an act committed under such circumstances. All the laws and customs of civilized warfare may not be applicable to an armed conflict with the Indian tribes upon our western frontier, but the circumstances attending the assassination of General Canby and Thomas, the U.S. Peace Commissioner, are such as to make their murder as much a violation of the laws of savage as of civilized warfare, and the Indians concerned in it fully understood the baseness and treachery of their act. Bird points out that, according to this line of thinking, anyone could be defined as Indian could thus be killed legally, and they also could be held responsible for defending themselves against any U.S. soldier. Quote, as a result, citizens of American Indian nations become in this moment the origin of the stateless terrorist combatant within U.S. enunciation of sovereignty. So this militarism has affected people all over the world. We know more about Afghanistan and Iraq because of, thank goodness for cell phone cameras, I guess we have to say, for even having that knowledge. They still have not released them on holding them, but enough of them got out that I think we got the idea. But there's much more. I always like to mention the Chagos Archipelago that comprises more than 60 small coral islands isolated in the Indian Ocean, halfway between Africa and Indonesia. It's 1,000 miles south of the nearest continent, India. Between 1968 and 1973, The United States and Britain, the latter being the colonial administrator, forcibly removed the indigenous inhabitants of the islands, the Chagossians. Most of the 2,000 deportees ended up more than 1,000 miles away in Mauritius and the Seychelles, where they were thrown into lives of poverty and forgotten. The purpose of this expulsion was to create a major U.S. military base on one of the Chagossian islands, Diego Garcia. As if being rounded up and removed from their homelands in the name of global security were not cruel enough, before being deported, the Chagossians had to watch as British agents and U.S. troops herded their pet dogs into sealed sheds where they were gassed and burned alive. As David Vine writes in his chronicle of this tragedy, "The base on Diego Garcia has become one of the most secretive and powerful U.S. military facilities in the world, helping to launch the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq twice, threatening Iran, China, Russia, and the nations from southern Africa to Southeast Asia, host to a secret CIA detention center for high-profile terror suspects, and home to thousands of U.S. military personnel and billions of dollars in deadly weaponry." The Chagossians are not the only indigenous peoples around the world that the U.S. military has displaced, less known than, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, where there are tens of millions of refugees, and of course Syria now too. The U.S. military established a pattern during and after the Vietnam War of forcibly removing indigenous peoples from sites deemed strategic for the placement of military bases. The peoples of the Bikini Atoll in the South Pacific and Puerto Rico's Vieques Island are perhaps the best known examples. But there were also the Inuit of Thule, Greenland, and the thousands of Okinawans and indigenous peoples of Micronesia. During the harsh deportations of the Micronesians in the 1970s, the press took some notice. It seemed very cruel as they watched it. In response to one reporter's question, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, war criminal that he is, said of the Micronesians, quote, "There are only 90,000 people out there. Who gives a damn?" This is a statement of permissive genocide. John Grenier notes that the cultural aspects of militarization run deep. They have historical roots, reaching into the nation's British colonial past and continuing unrelentingly with wars of conquest and ethnic cleansing over three centuries. Quoting Grenier, he makes another point that I think is most important that we understand. Beyond its sheer military utility, Americans also found a use for the first wave of war in the construction of an American identity. The enduring appeal of the romanticized myth of the settlement, never called conquest, of the frontier, either by actual men such as Robert Rogers or Daniel Boone, or fictitious ones like Nathaniel Bumppo of James Fenimore Cooper's creation, points to what D.H. Lawrence called the myth of the essential white American. As Jody Bird writes, "The story of the New World is horror. The story of America is a crime." When I read this phrasing of hers, I had a vision of the police, a crime scene with yellow tape around the crime scene, and sometimes it can be quite big. And what a great thing it would be to have a installation artist do something useful, like put yellow tape around the borders of the United States as a crime scene. I really challenge some artists to do that. Wouldn't be that expensive, actually, maybe. I don't know. It might be guerrilla actions. People could do it in different places, put out the yellow tape wherever they're nearest to the border. But it is a crime scene, and it needs to be dissected as a crime scene. It is necessary, she argues, to start with the origin of the United States as a settler state and its explicit intention to occupy the continent. These origins contain the historical seeds of genocide. Any true history of the United States must focus on what has happened to and with indigenous peoples and what still happens. It's not just past colonialist actions, but also the continued colonization of American Indian peoples, nations, and lands. Lakota scholar Elizabeth Cook Glenn spells out the connection between the Indian Wars, and she's thinking mainly as the Sioux Wars and the Iraq War. The current mission of the United States to become the center of political enlightenment, to be taught to the rest of the world, begins with the Indian Wars and has become the dangerous provocations of this nation's historical intent. The historical connection between the Little Bighorn event and the uprising in Baghdad must become part of the political dialogue of America if the fiction of decolonization is to happen and the hope for deconstruction of the colonial story is to come about. But there are a lot of barriers to that, and one that has been identified mainly by Canadian Native scholars is what they call a race to innocence. It really rings a bell, doesn't it? Race to innocence. That's what occurs when individuals assume that they are innocent of complicity in structures of domination and oppression. This concept captures the understandable assumption made by new immigrants or children of recent immigrants to any country. They cannot be responsible, they assume, for what occurred in their adopted country's past. Neither are those, though, who are already citizens, guilty, even as if they are descendants of slave owners, Indian killers, or Andrew Jackson himself. It doesn't go through the DNA. They're not responsible for their ancestors. Yet in a settler society that has not come to terms with its past, whatever historical trauma was entailed in settling the land, the poor pioneer and, you know, the Donner Party and all that, affects the assumptions and behavior of living generations at any given time, including immigrants and the children of recent immigrants. So in Canada, the Native people work very closely with immigrant groups, and it's an alliance we haven't developed here, but it's very important as they kind of interrupt the Canadian story that immigrants are given, and they build alliances among these, and I went to one of their conferences, about 5,000 people there, their 10th anniversary of their organization, No One is Illegal. And basically the Native people say, you know, you really have to decide if you're going to be an immigrant and take responsibility if you go to citizenship, or are you going to become a settler, just join the settler class. You have that choice, you know, you really do. You probably won't ever get as high as some, but then those settlers didn't either. But there are a lot of privileges there, and you can do that, but you have a choice to make, you know, a moral, ethical choice. And I don't think we give that challenge out, you know, here in North America as should be done. I mean, for the immigrants' own sake, you know, I'm thinking more of saving them from being complicit in this destructive regime than anything. So in the United States, the legacy of settler colonialism can be seen in the endless wars of aggression and occupations, the trillions spent on war machinery, military bases, and personnel instead of social services and quality public education, not to speak of highways and stuff, bridges. The gross profits of corporations, each of which has greater resources and funds more than half the countries in the world, yet pay minimal taxes and provide few jobs for U.S. citizens. The repression of generation after generation of activists who seek to change the system. The incarceration of the poor, particularly descendants of enslaved Africans. The individualism carefully inculcated that on the one hand produces self-blame for personal failure, and on the other exalts ruthless dog-eat-dog competition for possible success, even though it rarely results. And the high rates of suicide, drug abuse, alcoholism, sexual violence against women and children, homelessness, dropping out of school, and gun violence. These are symptoms, and there are many more, of a deeply troubled society, and they are not new. The large and influential civil rights, student, labor, and women's movements of the 1950s through the 1970s exposed the structural inequalities in the economy and the historical effects of more than two centuries of slavery and brutal genocidal wars waged against indigenous peoples. For a time, U.S. society verged on a process of truth-seeking regarding past atrocities, making demands to end aggressive wars and to end poverty, witnessed by the huge peace movement in the 1970s and the war on poverty that was, you know, really forced upon the administration to respond to the civil rights movement. Women's equity, prison reforms, school busing, affirmative action, reproductive rights, the promotion of the arts and humanities, public media, the Indian Self-Determination Act, and many other initiatives. A more sophisticated version of the race to innocence that helps perpetuate settler colonialism began to develop in social movements theories in the 1990s and led many backwards. If you look at it from the indigenous people's point of view. This is mainly popularized in the work of Michael Hart and Antonio Negri in Commonwealth, in their trilogy. But in Commonwealth, the third volume in the trilogy, the first one was Empire, and the second one was Multitude, and the third one is Commonwealth. This third one is very troublesome. It's one of a number of books in an academic fad of the early 21st century seeking to revive the medieval European concept of the commons as an aspiration for contemporary social movements. Most writing about the commons barely mention the fate of indigenous peoples in relation to the call for all land to be shared. Two Canadian scholar activists, Nandita Sharma and Cynthia Wright, for example, do not mince words in rejecting native land claims and sovereignty, characterizing them as xenophobic elitism. They see indigenous claims as, quote, regressive neo-racism in the light of global diasporas arising from oppression around the world. Those darn Indians wanting something when all this other oppression is going on. Cree scholar Lorraine LeCamp calls this kind of erasure of indigenous peoples in North America terra nullism. That's interesting because, you know, terra nullis is a part of the ethos of colonizing North America, that there were no people there. It's the Israeli refrain to, you know, a people without land, a land without people for people without land, terra nullism. So this is another form of terra nullism, harking back to the characterization under the doctrine of discovery of purportedly vacant lands as terra nullis. This is kind of a no-fault history. From the theory of a liberated future with no borders and nations, of a vague commons for all, the theorists obliterate the present and presence of indigenous nations struggling for their liberation from states of colonialism. Thereby, indigenous rhetoric and programs for decolonization, nationhood, and sovereignty are, according to this project, rendered invalid and futile. From the indigenous perspective, any notion of the commons that speaks for and as indigenous, as it advocates transforming indigenous governance or incorporating indigenous peoples into a multitude that might then reside on those lands forcibly taken from indigenous peoples, does nothing to disrupt the genocidal and colonialist intent of the initial and now repeated historical process. So I'll end with this story, kind of a local story, about ghosts and demons that we live with. A living symbol of this that's always fascinated me, as well as a kind of general subconscious knowledge of it, of the genocidal past, is the Winchester Mystery House. How many of you have been to the Winchester Mystery House? You'll want to go after you hear this. Or you'll want to go back, because you may not think of it as such when you're going through it. Well, for those of you who don't know, it's a tourist site in the Santa Clara, now called Silicon Valley, of Northern California. 50 miles south of San Francisco, it is billed as a ghost house on billboards that start appearing in Oregon to the north and San Diego to the south. Sarah L. Winchester, the wealthy widow of William Wirt Winchester, built the Victorian mansion to avoid and elude ghosts, although there is no record of any ghosts ever having found their way into her home. It could be said, perhaps, that Mrs. Winchester's project from 1884 to her death in 1922 was a great success, that she kept the ghosts out. She likely was very well aware of the widely publicized ghost dance in 1890 when she was speeded up. There was a period of time when she really speeded up her building. And this, the ghost dance led to the killing of Sitting Bull and the Wounded Knee Massacre of 1890. The dancers believed that the dance would bring back their dead warriors. It makes sense that Mrs. Winchester felt the need to guard herself from the ghosts of those killed by the Winchester repeating rifle, which her late husband's father had invented and produced in 1866, with later models being more lethal. Mrs. Winchester inherited the fortune accumulated by her husband's family through the sales of the rifle. There was one major purchaser, the United States Department of War. They actually used to call it accurately the Department of War, by the way. The chief reason for the War Department's purchases of the rifle in great quantities was to kill Indians. That was the only purpose for it. The rifle was a technological innovation designed especially for the U.S. Army's campaigns against Plains Indians following the Civil War. The Winchester House amazes all who tour it. There are five floors, more or less, since they are staggered. It looks like a Victorian house, built in, you know, begun in the Victorian era. Each room in itself appears normal, decorated in the late 19th century mode. But there's more than meets the eye in getting from parlors to bedrooms to kitchens to closets and from floor to floor. Numerous stairways dead end, and secret trap doors hide the actual stairways. Closet doors open to walls, and pieces of furniture are really doors to closets. Huge bookcases serve as entrances to adjoining rooms. Part of the house was unfinished when the widow died, as she had construction workers building every day from dawn to dusk, adding rooms and traps until her death. Visitors trekking through the widow's home are astounded and perhaps saddened by the evidence all around them of the fears and anguish of an obviously mentally disturbed person. Yet there is another possibility. A sense of the scaffolding that supports U.S. society, a kind of hologram in the minds of each and every person on the continent who doesn't express it or can't afford to build against the ghost, but find other ways to constant consumerism, you know, all kinds of protective gear to, and wars in order to not be attacked. Mrs. Winchester might have been more aware of the truth and more than most people, and therefore fearful of its consequences. Regardless, in continuing to find or invent enemies across the globe, expand what is already the largest military force in the world, and add to an elaborate global network of military bases, all in the name of national or global security, does not the United States resemble Mrs. Winchester's constantly trying to foil her ghosts? The guilt harbored by most is buried and expressed in other ways, on a larger scale, as regeneration through violence. So how can the United States society, how can we come to terms with this past? How can we acknowledge responsibility, take responsibility, embrace it? The late Native historian Jack Forbes always stressed, he was one of my mentors, that one of the people I dedicated this book to, he always stressed that while living persons are not responsible for what their ancestors did, they are responsible for the society they live in, which is a product of that past. We're all responsible. Assuming this responsibility provides a means of survival and liberation. It's not a negative thing. Everyone and everything in the world is affected, for the most part negatively, by U.S. dominance and intervention, often violently through direct military means or through proxies. Indigenous peoples offer possibilities for life after empire, possibilities that neither erase the crimes of colonialism nor require the disappearance of the original peoples colonized under the guise of including them as individuals in a multicultural order. That process rightfully starts by honoring the treaties the United States made with indigenous nations, making that an integral part of every social movement, making that demand, raising consciousness about it, learning the details, by restoring all sacred sites, starting with the Black Hills and including most federally held parks and land and all stolen sacred items and body parts, and by payment of sufficient reparations for the reconstruction and expansion of Native nations. In the process, the continent will be radically reconfigured physically and psychologically. For the future to be realized, it will require extensive organizing, educational programs that best come from grassroots organizing, and seeps into the schools in that way, and the full support and active participation of the descendants of settlers, enslaved Africans and colonized Mexicans, as well as immigrant populations. Quoting the words of Acoma poet Simon Ortiz from his book on the Sand Creek Massacre from Sand Creek, "The future will not be mad with loss and waste, though the memory will be there. Eyes will become kind and deep, and the bones of this nation will mend after the revolution." Now, you don't have a microphone, but this thing comes out if someone wants to. Oh, he can go around to you. Yeah, great. Our tech is still here.
So while he's getting the mic ready, I just encourage people, if you want to come up a little closer, there's going to be a projection pretty soon. So if you want to sit closer, either to get closer to Roxanne or to get ready for the slideshow.
I don't think anyone can hear you. I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, I'll say that again.
If you want to come closer, now might be a great time. Roxanne's going to take a few questions. I'll pass around the mic. Also, you might want to sit closer because there's going to be a presentation next. So I'll just make a comment to break the ice, which was, and this is so fundamental, listening to you, I realized that sometimes when we heard about the Iraq War, the photographs you mentioned of torture, that it seems like it's shocking and new, and you're telling us, of course, it's not new. It's been policy since the beginning. And on the other hand, we think about history and we think such horrible things happened in the past. Thank God we don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of denial in both ways, right? Mm-hmm. So who would like to ask a question of Dr. Dunbar Ortiz?
Don't everyone jump up at once.
I'm wondering how you feel about the Father Sarah's issue now with the missions.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean to bring it up every time I speak, and of course this is California, and there is a mission nearby that could be a good object of protest. Well, You know, it's, we've been fighting it. I've supported California Indians, Mission Indians, who've been fighting this. So all California Indians are united in Northern California. This is, I think Sonoma was the northernmost mission because they didn't get any farther than that. But it's absolutely cruel and inhuman punishment for the survivors of those missions to, and I would say also to, you know, the citizens of California who think these are quaint, lovely things. You know, it's almost a kind of a form of madness to regard them as such. I always tell people, yeah, go visit the mission, but look at what's in the middle of the courtyard. What is that thing that's not, there's not even a plaque there that says it's the whipping post. The whipping post. It doesn't say anything. I just know it. You know, I was at Santa Clara University in law school, and there's a mission right on campus, you know. That mission is there, and it's a Jesuit school. And I walk over, and I had never gone to it. I just couldn't stand to go to the missions. But you can't avoid it there to go to the cafeteria. You have to walk past the mission. And I notice this thing, and I go over to see what it is, and I'm looking, and I... Oh, yeah, you know, I've read about this because I studied. That's the whipping post. But why don't they label it, you know? And because that's the essence. I mean, that's the essence of the mission system, that Junipero Serra was no symbolic architect. He was involved. He went on the raids on horseback with the Spanish military to round up Native people and kill them if they wouldn't come, take their children, rip them out of mother's arms. There's so much documentation. There's a new book out, by the way, by Elliot, what's his last name?
Castillo.
Yeah. Elliot Castillo. Very timely. I'm sure he couldn't have known, but it's real providence that right now it has come out right the month that the Pope Francis, whom we want to like a little bit, announced the canonization and insidiously did it in the same breath that he announced the beatification of Archbishop Romero of El Salvador. Well, I can believe that they'll find three miracles for Archbishop Romero was a miracle in himself. But how are they going to find three? They haven't found them. You know, it's been going on for years, this beatification. So he just announced it. Okay, they'll make it up, I guess. They make it up anyway. But it won't be convincing. So I think that, you know, it's really an uphill battle because it was greeted with delight, you know, by town fathers, and especially in California, the mission, where the missions are big tourist attractions. I noted that he's not coming to California to do this canonization. I wonder why. He's doing it in Philadelphia. Isn't that strange? I'm thinking, he doesn't want the demonstrations, but it means people are going to have to go to Philadelphia, you know, and protest. But I hope that something can be done to interrupt this process, you know. I can't imagine what, well, you know, he's Argentine, and Argentina is also a settler state, and the, you know, the mestizo, the dominant people there, and many are immigrants, Italian immigrants, especially German, is a duplicate of the United States without being, you know, a world power that's hurting a lot of other people around the world. It's just hurting the Mapuches. There, and they had almost exactly, in fact, they took the roadmap, the blueprint from what was happening in the United States in conquering the Pampas and Patagonia and all. So he comes from that mindset, you know, that is stronger in the Americas. I almost think that a European pope would have been, you know, just kept putting it off just because they have to know the truth, you know. It's like that this is a really, really, truly form of genocide. The man is an architect of genocide. So I hope everyone will get involved in whatever protests there are, signing petitions or whatever you can do. Write letters to the editor.
And I'll toss in a note on that. I just saw a talk by, I believe she's the director of the California Indian Museum, which I think is in Santa Rosa.
Yeah.
And it was a history of the missions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know a class where that might be appropriate, I can't volunteer her, but it might be a great idea to ask her. And I'm also going to put in a plug before we take the next question that I promised you I'd show you Roxanne's book, and here it is. And as she said, she wrote it partly to be readable by, you know, the public, but also could be a text or a supplemental text in the classroom. And you're paying for your education, so you might consider making this part of the class you're taking.
And there are some faculty members here from the junior college at Santa Rosa who are using parts of the book.
You. Do you want to say something about it? Or not be put on the spot?
Yeah, go ahead and say it. Put you on the spot?
Well, I have read a good bit of the book, and I've used some chapters, and I'm planning to use it in my class, because I figure I've been focusing so much on slavery and Jim Crow and immigrations from Eastern Europe, etc., but this is where I need to start. This is, like, absolutely where I need to start.
Thank you.
My name is Ann Neal.
What do you teach?
Race relations, race and ethnic relations in sociology.
Race relations and ethnic studies?
Race
and ethnic relations and sociology.
In sociology.
I'll come up and talk to your class in the fall if you'd like.
That would be fantastic.
Other questions or comments?
I was just wondering how you got into this realm of study. What pulled you? What was fascinating to you and sort of your own personal history around?
Yeah, it was a combination of how I grew up, you know, what they used to call half-breeds. My mother was half-breed, as they call it, you know, kind of detached from there. With all these wars, you know, there's a tremendous disruption of Native societies, refugees all over the place, and who scattered here and there, you know, kind of lost. And one of the projects of the American Indian Movement in the 1970s was to, and there was a similar movement, completely separate, we didn't meet each other until 1977, South American Indian Council out of Bolivia, to rescue the lost Indians. So I kind of, you know, came into the American Indian Movement like that. But I was very aware of where I grew up. Everything was segregated in Oklahoma when I grew up, pretty segregated now. But there were mostly people lived in small towns or farming communities and not in cities. And there were white towns, Indian towns, and black towns. The black towns were mostly in the eastern part of the state. The Indian towns were all over because it was Indian territory, and the white towns were all over. But in the county where I grew up, there were dozens of Southern Cheyenne, Arapaho. It was their old reservation land before it was allotted and taken away from them. And we used to play basketball with them, but I was in a white town because my father was white. And this awareness, and also learning very early, actually meeting a Palestinian at the University of Oklahoma when I was only 18, who described to me, you know, what had happened there only a few years earlier at that time, and his family driven out. And he said, it's just like your people here. And I said, what do you mean my people? And he says, well, the Indians here, because I didn't identify as an Indian, you know, even though I didn't say I wasn't, but it didn't mean anything to me because I didn't grow up in the culture. So he said, "It's I'm not sure he used the term settler colonialism, but he made me see my own, you know, the soup that I grew up in a very different way than I did just saying, this is just the way the world is. You know, there are Indian towns and white towns, and they get in fights at the basketball game, and then, you know, that's life. So I had this awareness, but then when I I moved to California in 1960. I went to San Francisco State. It wasn't yet a roiling revolutionary project as it was in 68 and still. It was 1960 to 1963 that I was there. But there was a lot of activity, especially the civil rights activity. The Hallinan brothers were students there, and Danny Glover, and, you know, all these activists. And I kind of, you know, I wasn't politicized, really. I was trying to find a way to understand things. So I took different courses, found them all interesting, but I took a history course, a world history course. At San Francisco State back then, it was so, there were too many people for not enough classrooms and teachers. So in your first year, you know, first, until you got to be a senior, you just took whatever you could, and especially if you had to work, which most students did, whatever fit the time. And so I took economic geography and historical geology, and I took all these strange courses because they were available, astronomy, but I did psychology, which I never would have taken. I did get in a world history course, and I hadn't even thought of majoring in history. I kind of wanted to major in philosophy, but I took a course and made really poor grades in it. They were all men. Of course, in history, they are too, but these were not fields that welcomed women at the time. But that history course transformed me because I happened to have a professor, Theodor Treutlein, who was from German immigrant family. He had studied at UC Berkeley in the history department, and his specialization was Unipracera and the mission system. And this was incredible to me because he also, at that time, they had a project, Woodrow Wilson, Bora, and others, they called it the Berkeley School of History, which I wish would come back because it was hemispheric history and comparative colonialisms. And so I was introduced to that, and it made me fall in love with history. I made it a major, but also that, you know, that subject matter within history. So I went to Berkeley. He got me in Berkeley, a graduate school, just called up his friends there and said, let her in. And I was, wow, was I ever in the wrong place, you know, way above my head. They only had European history there. The whole system was divided between different campuses. So I wanted to study European colonialism. But that's not exactly what they were teaching, European history. They're teaching the Renaissance, the Reformation. And I took courses. I found them really interesting. I was kind of shocked when I went in my first European history seminar, and it was in German. And the professor was German. I said, I don't think it was. I wanted to learn about German history, but I said, I think I better take another. I passed a German reading exam, but I certainly couldn't keep up with the lecture, the talk, you know, the discussion. So I transferred to UCLA, and that's where they do area histories. They do African studies, Latin American studies, some Asian. They did Asian history at Berkeley, but they do more concentrated Asian history. So that had been set up, you know, in the master plan of the UC system. And so I decided I would just have to do Latin American history in order to pursue this subject matter, because it didn't exist in U.S. history anymore. Treutlein gave me the impression, you know, that because he was still living in the past, that this was still a viable field, and it wasn't. So I did Latin American history at UCLA, and I kind of, then all of framing I did of the United States, because I did have the United States as one of my six fields, but I saw it through my specialization, which was colonialism and imperialism, what it looked like, and the United States looked just the same, you know, pretty much the same. And so that's, you know, it's been both, and then I became an activist during that time, and eventually found the, you know, hooked up with the American Indian Movement after Wounded Knee. I didn't really, I was urged by many, you know, to get involved, but I got involved in, you know, the anti-war movement, of course the civil rights movement, but also the anti-apartheid movement. And I didn't feel, you know, I wanted to leave these things that I was working on as a student. The Vietnam War seemed so pressing. And then the women, I felt, you know, we really had women had to be freed from their bondage, even in movements, to be able to be full force. So I jumped into women's liberation movement. And it was only in, you know, 1973 that I had to start really seriously thinking. I got recruited, actually, while I was a law student at University of Santa Clara to work on the Wounded Knee legal defense. The lawyers were over there combing for, you know, for students. I said, oh, yeah, well, I'll do that. So that's how I got involved as an activist. But I already had the, you know, the kind of personal background and the academic preparation, which at that time was kind of new, the colonialism as the framework, even for indigenous scholars, a few that there were. But there were, there was Jack Forbes was already, you know, doing that, Howard Adams in Canada, and Vine Deloria. So those are the three people I dedicate the book to, because I feel like they gave me the grounding. You know, they were really mentors that where I could, because I had done it in great strokes and mainly done Spanish colonialism, and so I was able to expand and do treaty, you know, understand treaties and land bases and in the United States sovereignty.
So I think we might have time for one more quick question.
Yeah. Sometime over the last year, reservations have now been given the power to deal with the rape of the women by non-reservation people who have generally been white men.
Right.
How do you see this as contributing to maybe the growth of and deepening of the autonomy of reservations?
Well, you know, it's become publicized. It's like many things that it probably hasn't increased at all. It's always been there. We've always known about it. I became very aware of it when I was director of Native American Studies at University of New Mexico in 1978, '79, '80, that my students were getting raped when they went home. And, you know, often by the state police who would come into the reservation. So it's not new, but it finally, an Amnesty International report, the way you know about it and the way it's gotten publicized, the Amnesty International report, which is basically written by this Cherokee scholar, Andrea Smith. They recruited her to come and work with them and do this report. And she was already doing stuff on the boarding schools and had a lot of good contacts. So she basically did the research and documented the numbers, the occurrence, and who's doing it, and what the problem was. That there's the United States, in reneging on its treaty agreements, passed, of course, Congress has that power to pass a law that can dissolve certain treaty, usually they make some kind of exceptions to a treaty. But generally, if you break a treaty with another nation, that nation has the right to go to war, you know. But Native people being disarmed and on reservations, so it's not likely they could use this by the 1880s. So Congress just passed a Major Crimes Act, several different Major Crimes Act, that removed the sovereignty, the police powers of Native American governments on their own land base. Some of them were still being occupied by the U.S. military, but in those treaties, they actually had the right to prosecute any outsiders that came in, and the U.S. government had the right to prosecute any Indians who did something outside the reservation. So these major crime acts, the federal government has police power, which basically means the FBI. If you go to an federal Indian reservation, the first sign you will see after a bunch of church signs is the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, has criminal jurisdiction on this reservation. But they're never there, except if there's some kind of political uprising to go put it down. You know, they're never there. They don't have forces there to stop predators. So it's like putting green lights around reservations for predators. Nothing will happen to you. You go rape anyone you want, children, boys, girls, older women, whatever you want to do, and nothing will happen to you. And that's basically what, you know, it's just like predators who prey on children. They know where to go and how to do it and how to get by with it. Very few get caught. So it's been going on for years and years and years and decades, and ever since the police power was taken away. It's also always been and is being exposed also in Canada, the same situation. And it's also morphed into, with all those man camps, as they call them, up in the fields of, you know, Manitoba, North Dakota, South Dakota, of these migrant oil workers. They aren't, but they have to be, you know, they're there without their families or anything, living in trailers and shacks and sometimes in the park sleeping out. But there's a thriving sex trade now. And so many of these women on reservations, not just on those reservations, but especially nearby in Minnesota and the Anishinaabe reservations, of young women being taken and forced into sex slavery or being enticed out, you know, just like as it were, how it works. That's something new. It was always the incoming, but now there's also this taking women out to be in sexual bondage. So you may remember the debate over renewing the Violence Against Women Act, which was first enacted in 1994. And it's one of those things that everyone voted for. It's bipartisan. Who's for violence against women, you know, at least in formally? And every Congress, every time it comes up for renewal, which all these things do, it's just rubber stamp. So after this amnesty report, the Native women's organizations, and they called on National Organization for Women for support and other women's groups, local women's groups, to insert a new paragraph that would fund the tribal police actually make them into federal, when it came to those kinds of crimes, acting as federal agents in order to prosecute, you know, arrest and prosecute outsiders, usually white men, but, you know, others too. I mean, and so suddenly the Republican Congress said no. You know, we're not going to do that. Get Indians back their police power. You know, liberal Democrats are kind of clueless sometimes because it never occurs to them that wouldn't be acceptable, you know, that there is this deep sentiment of keeping the colonial state intact and that this is part of the process, had no police powers, no control over your own lives. And so they were kind of shocked, and there was this kind of outrage, I mean, women's groups all over, not because they supported necessarily even knew about this clause that was put in, this new part, but because they weren't renewing the Violence Against Women Act, which is, you know, everyone supported. So they were kind of, it's kind of egg on their face, so they backed down, and it did go through. So that's happening now, and there was even some implementation legislation for funding for the training to, so it's in place now, but that doesn't mean, you know, tribal governments are very poor. the police very large areas without much manpower aren't always the best trained and are mostly men, which is, you know, also a problem with sometimes with sex crimes. So it's not like it's resolved, but it that is how we all know about it now because of, you know, the Violence Against Women Act and also the Amnesty report. So those things can really make a difference in public consciousness. Yeah.
And that brings us back up to the present. So I just want to ask you all to join me in thanking Dr.
Thank you.
And next up, like I said, if you want to stretch your legs and come over closer, I'm going to be introducing Nancy Mancias from Code Pink, who's going to talk about the connection of this history of the colonial state you've heard to what we're seeing in our modern wars, and specifically around torture and war criminals. And I know this is heavy stuff, and you just listen to a lot of heavy stuff, but I really believe that by understanding not only the history, but how our issues link together, we have a better chance of taking down the colonial state. So.
Is this Nancy?
This is Nancy.
Hi, Nancy.
So Nancy Mancias is a campaign organizer for Code Pink who creates beautiful trouble. She's here with us tonight to discuss modern torture and terror warfare as practiced by the United States and resisted by the public. From Guantanamo to the torture report, through citizens' campaigns like War Criminals Watch, Code Pink and Nancy work to hold former Bush and Obama administration officials accountable for illegal military interventions and drone wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia that continue to kill innocent civilians. Please welcome Nancy Mancias.